Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LXVII, Heir and a Spare. You thought Antoninus Pius was a tough act to follow? Then allow me to introduce you to Marcus Aurelius. Emperor, warrior, philosopher, leader, lover, all-round good guy. Oh, and let's not forget his younger brother Lucius Verus. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus are the heirs of Antoninus Pius in a decision made by Antoninus Pius's predecessor, Hadrian. So Antoninus Pius, in order to become Hadrian's heir, had to adopt the next generation.
So this all became part of a big succession plan, which pretty much sets Rome up for the next, you know, conceivably 50-odd years or so.
Yeah, you could see it as Hadrian being a real control freak in that he's ensuring the succession, ensuring his legacy for a couple of generations. This is the kind of thing that often would go wrong, but for Hadrian, it actually worked.
So was it a case of an heir and a spare, or were they both intended to be, as turns out, to be co-emperors?
We don't know. The intention seems to have been co-emperorship, but it may well be that there's a paranoia about people dropping off the twig, because they had so often in Rome's history, and Hadrian himself had experienced losing someone he'd intended to be the heir. So it sort of makes sense that you have two possibilities there. You can stage it as co-heirs so that both of them have some kind of motivation to be brought up with this intention in mind. And there's also a bit of an age gap between them. So if Antoninus Pius happens to outlive Marcus Aurelius, which he didn't, then Lucius Verus is more likely to still be alive because there's about a 10-year age gap between them.
Yeah. So who were these two likely young lads?
Well, Lucius Verus was the son of someone whom Hadrian intended to be his heir. So he had been renamed after Hadrian. He was Lucius Aelius Caesar. So Aelius is Hadrian's family name.
That's right. He was quite sickly and he died before Hadrian did.
Yes.
And predeceased him. Great choice there for...
Yeah. See, this is what I mean about, you know, having failed before.
Yes.
So he's got that connection with Hadrian. And Marcus Aurelius is distantly related and quite nearly related to previous Antonine emperors in a couple of ways, mostly through the female line. So he's the nephew of Antoninus Pius's wife, Faustina. He's also, if we go back far enough, he is the great-grandson of Hadrian's wife.
Okay.
So Sabina's mother's great. Yeah, so he's got links throughout that family, and he will marry further into it even, so he will make those links even stronger. It's not terribly surprising that both Lucius Verus and Marcus Aurelius will figure in the succession.
All right, so before we wade into who Marcus Aurelius was as a young man, can we unpack, as we always do, the sources and give you your obligatory chance to complain about how inaccurate the Augustan histories are? Off you go, Rhiannon. Wound up. Release.
The poor old Augustan histories, they are inaccurate and there are problems with them. But at the same time, we have to be quite grateful because Dio is starting to get a bit threadbare by this point. So we've got Dio, but one of the books is in Epitome. So, you know, it's very brief. It's been epitomized, summarized later on. And so we kind of rely on the Augustan history a lot more at this point.
But also, we do have the letters of Fronto.
Yes, and that's quite interesting because that gives us the personal correspondence with his own teacher, and his teachers seem to have been really important to him. So we've got kind of an idea of what's going on in his head, his day-to-day movements through this very close relationship with Fronto. And that's something that we haven't really had with emperors before, so that's really interesting. And we've also got Marcus's own writings. His meditations.
Which come up later on in his life.
Yes.
So really this is, you know, quite a lot that we've got, aside from having something like Tacitus or Suetonius.
Well, we're pretty blessed compared to what we had with Trajan, where there's no biography. We have a bit of correspondence with Pliny, but not nearly as much as there is with Fronto. Yeah, it's not bad in terms of sources for ancient emperors.
All right, so let's unpack who he was as a young man a bit. What do we know about Marcus Aurelius's childhood?
Well, his family's from Spain. Spain is very powerful in the second century because it's generated a number of emperors already with Trajan and Hadrian.
Mm.
They had become quite powerful in the first century CE. At least, you know, they've become aristocratic and they've got senators in the family. And they were very wealthy by the time Marcus was born. And he already has links with Hadrian, not through just both being from Spain, but because his grandfather was a friend of Hadrian's. And he was brought up by his paternal grandfather because his own father had died when he was quite young.
Mm.
So he's got this family that's full of important politicians, consuls. His grandfather, indeed, was actually consul the year that he was born in 121 CE.
At this point in time, what is his name? Because it clearly isn't the name that he's going to end up with, Marcus Aurelius.
Well, of course, we have a lot of people changing their names when they get adopted.
And yeah.
Emperors often change their names. He starts off as Marcus Annius Verus. So when he is adopted...
This is by his paternal grandfather.
By his grandfather. He slightly extends his name to include the Aurelius bit. So that's where we get Marcus Aurelius. Then he's Marcus Aelius Aurelius Verus. When he's adopted, he changes his name again. So by then it includes the word Caesar, Caesar. And he gets a bit of the piety of Antoninus Pius. He gets to be P. Filius, the son of the pious one.
Right.
And then when he becomes emperor, it's going to change again and he'll get a whole raft of titles, including imperator.
What sort of student was he? We know a bit from learning about him with Fronto, but what's this from the perspective of Marcus Aurelius?
He seems to have been a boy who was really interested in learning and philosophy and scholarship. So at the age of 12, he's already dressing up as a philosopher. He's kind of the ancient version of a geeky student. I'm quite fond of him for this. I'm less fond of him for this aspect. He begins to practice and endure hardship, ascetic lifestyle, so
right.
that he can put up with, say, fasting for 2 days or not putting the heating on or living out in the wilds to prove that he can do it. And this is because he's starting to embrace, we presume, the Stoic lifestyle way. You don't kind of respond to outside stimuli.
Yeah.
So he's a good student. He later on was supposed to have had gold statues of his teachers put up around his household. I don't know that many emperors did that. I mean, Nero had his teacher killed. We think back to Seneca. So Marcus has a lot of respect for people of learning. He's employing philosophers early on. So we know that one of the Stoics who educated him was a man called Apollonius of Chalcedon, who was also Lucius Verus's teacher. And he has a lot of respect for the Stoic philosopher Junius Rusticus, who is given honours because of Marcus's respect. So he's not just there as a personal teacher. He's somebody that Marcus will demonstrate his respect for, and we're told that Rusticus received the kiss of greeting before the prefects of the guards. So he's kind of put above the military figures, which you would think might generate some kind of resentment, but as we'll see, it seems very hard for people to dislike Marcus Aurelius. He's consistently popular.
Yeah.
And he also gets political power out of this. So Rusticus is made consul twice. So there's this connection with Marcus Aurelius between learning and power, which we haven't necessarily seen in the past.
And as we also know, he's getting lessons in Latin from Fronto, and he's getting lessons in Greek from, amongst others, Atticus.
This is Herodes Atticus, who is not only known as a teacher of Marcus Aurelius, but if you go to Athens, for example, there are structures there that were built by Herodes Atticus. His name means Attic, Athenian. And for example, he built the theatre of Herodes Atticus, which is sort of built into the Acropolis of Athens.
Okay.
So his name is on the landscape, as it were. So he's an important figure in terms of, I guess, kind of almost representing the Roman administration in the Greek world.
The other important thing that I suppose to know about Marcus Aurelius as a young man is that he became very close to Hadrian even before he was adopted. So there was a good pre-existing relationship there, wasn't there?
Yeah, and this whole kind of relationship through family connections seems to result in, I guess, what we've seen ever since the imperial family was installed, but the elevation of people when they're very, very young. Mm. So way back, Augustus's family, you know, his grandsons were made consuls when they were like 15 or something. And this is the kind of thing that Marcus Aurelius is getting as young as the age of 6. So he's enrolled in the Equestrian Order, that second order below the senators, at the age of 6. He's admitted to a college of priests at 8, the Salian priests, which is one of the oldest Roman priesthoods. And, I mean, how can he actually carry out any of these activities at the age of 8?
Mm.
Although he does seem to have been quite precocious. This is already putting him on the course to being an important figure. He's being marked out from the very beginning.
I mean, I'm sure I'm possibly reading too much into this, and I know that we can't know this, but maybe Hadrian saw something of himself in the young boy as well, if he was quite a good student who liked to think philosophically.
Well, given that Hadrian is so interested in the Greek world and
yes,
philosophy is an important part of that culture, even the symbolism of wearing the beard, which of course Marcus Aurelius will continue, is associated with Greek philosophers. So, yeah, it's not surprising that the two had some kind of simpatico relationship.
As always with a good young emperor, there was an omen at this point, wasn't there? I always love a good omen.
Yeah, most of these are probably made-up stories, you realise.
Oh, yeah, of course, in retrospect,
because it's good to have an omen when you know that person actually had great success in later life.
Yes.
This priesthood that he'd been enrolled into, the Salii, one of their strange rituals is to throw garlands onto a banqueting couch, and Marcus Aurelius's didn't reach the couch. It fell instead over the head of a statue of Mars,
ooh,
who is the father of Rome.
Yes, yes.
So the symbolism there is
that he has bad aim.
That he's destined for greatness at Rome, that he's been blessed by the god who's important to Rome and Roman military affairs. So yeah, it's all there.
When Marcus Aurelius reaches the age of 15, he is betrothed to somebody rather important at the time then, I suppose.
Yes, to a woman called Caonia Fabia, Aelius's daughter. So the man who's supposed to be the next emperor.
Yes, yeah.
His daughter. So that'll bring Marcus Aurelius into the fold of the succession.
Yes.
It's a succession that doesn't happen because Aelius dies before Hadrian. But that is the sister of Lucius Verus,
who I was about
will
to say,
end
yeah,
up being co-emperor with Marcus Aurelius.
Sure.
The marriage never happens, however. Hadrian, he continues to throw honours at Marcus Aurelius before his time. So at the age of 17, which is normally about the age when you would get the toga virilis and become a man, but that's already happened to Marcus Aurelius. He got it a little bit early. At that age, he's made quaestor, which is an important magistracy. That's in 139 CE. So he's making his way through what we call the cursus honorum, the ladder of ranks,
yeah,
at early age.
So it's small wonder then that he was made an heir.
Yeah, it's really looking that way from early on. So we imagine even if Hadrian's plans hadn't gone awry, if Aelius had succeeded him, then probably one of the conditions would be that Marcus Aurelius were adopted and would be one of the successors, as he was. You know, whoever Hadrian leaves in succession to him is going to have to adopt Marcus Aurelius. That's how it's looking.
And although he was much younger, who was Lucius Verus?
Lucius Verus was the son of the Lucius Verus who should have, or Aelius, we should call him, who should have succeeded Hadrian had he not died.
Yes.
So he's kind of the next generation of Hadrian's plan anyway.
So after the death of Aelius, he would have found himself still in Hadrian's family tree. And I guess a logical person to slip into the succession plan there.
Yes. And if Aelius had become emperor, then he would have naturally been a successor anyway.
Mm.
So I assume that if Aelius had lived, he would have had his own son to succeed him and probably been told to adopt Marcus Aurelius.
What's his background like?
His background is very aristocratic too. He's got, you know, a whole host of consular ancestors. When he was born, his father was praetor, which is only one down from being consul. That's at the end of 130 on the 15th of December, which is coincidentally the birthday of Nero.
Yeah.
Well, that you could take that as a bad omen.
Yes,
if
bad
you
omen.
To.
Bad omen. And he had much the same upbringing, more or less, as Marcus Aurelius. Same teachers in some cases.
Yeah, he's in the same environment
yep,
because after his father dies, he's within Hadrian's household. getting the lessons from the same philosophers, it doesn't seem to have had the same impact on him, however. So Lucius Verus is originally called Lucius Caonius Commodus. He gets the Aurelius buried into his name upon adoption, and then his name will change again when he becomes emperor, and it will include Kaiser and Imperator and all of those things.
Yes.
His name never gets quite as long as Marcus Aurelius's. I think we should mention that.
Okay. The last thing that happens in the succession plan, and happens not long after Hadrian passes away, is that there's a change in who's marrying who at that point, isn't there?
Yes.
Marcus Aurelius was originally intended to marry the daughter of Aelius, but that changes.
Yeah, and that's because of Antoninus Pius. He changes that plan and gets Marcus Aurelius to marry his own daughter. So Antoninus Pius's daughter, who's called Faustina, named after her mother, so we tend to call her Faustina the Younger. Now, this just looks like they're passing women around, because Hadrian had intended Faustina the Younger to marry Lucius Verus. And I guess Antoninus Pius is very definitely putting Marcus Aurelius in the senior position, so he wants his daughter to marry the senior successor. And who knows, maybe he could already see that Marcus Aurelius was going to be the steadier character, and decided that would be a better deal for his daughter.
Lucius Verus, who was originally intended to marry Faustina the Younger, then went on to marry instead Marcus Aurelius's daughter,
who's called Annia Aurelia Galeria Lucilla.
Antoninus Pius becomes emperor, and Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus spend probably what they didn't intend, the next 23 years in training.
Yeah. It feels like it's taking a long time for Marcus Aurelius to become emperor, doesn't it?
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, and you know, it's in some ways it's no bad thing, because he gets lots of opportunities to hold particularly political roles.
Yeah.
And priesthoods are political roles, basically, but he's also consul in 140 and at other points. He gets extra names like Caesar. And he gets to be married and to start to produce what is meant to be the next generation of emperors. Sadly, most of them will die before him. At this point, it's very clear that Marcus Aurelius, remember, he is 10 years older, but he's very much being put forward as the preferred heir.
Yeah.
So although they end up being co-emperors, it looks like Antoninus Pius is giving him more experience, more practice, more training, giving him higher roles and even higher names. So he's given the title Caesar, whereas Lucius Verus gets son of Augustus. It sort of infantilizes him, while Marcus Aurelius is shown as someone with responsibility, getting all of these roles. He's generally staying at Rome, so he's not going off and getting military experience at this point.
Yeah.
But he's very much involved in the administration of the court and the empire, at least from Rome. Lucius Verus isn't really been given much responsibility, and certainly if you were someone who argued that the outcome comes from your upbringing, then you'd say that it's not surprising that he seems to have turned out to be something of a playboy.
Yeah.
He hasn't been shown the responsibility of being emperor, and when he's given it, he doesn't really use it. He gets other people to do the job for him quite often. So Lucius Verus is more into chariot racing and gladiatorial matches. He holds them at his own home. He has rowdy parties. This will actually continue even when he goes off on campaign.
Yeah.
And we're told in the much bemoaned Historia Augusta that when Marcus heard of the dinners, he groaned and bemoaned the fate of the empire. So it's that kind of feeling about Lucius Verus coming out of the Historia Augusta.
So generally, though, he had the same kind of rank, so being made quaestor, being made consul, but
quite a lot later.
Quite a lot later.
Not as many roles.
Yeah.
And sort of punctuated by periods where he's not given any responsibilities. You could make the modern parallels if you want, where in the British monarchy, because Charles is the one who's always been destined to be king, Prince Andrew was the playboy type, and I think people say somewhat the same about William and Harry.
In 161, Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Commodus, at that point, serves a consulship together, and that's the same year that Antoninus Pius dies, so they have a year where they're co-consuls, and then they'll move into being co-emperors.
Yeah, it seems quite...
Omen.
quite symbolic, I was about to say.
It's an omen.
Yeah. That they are equals as consuls, yeah. And that's the year they get to be equals as emperors.
They never really turn out to be equals, though, do they? So what happens when Antoninus Pius dies?
Well, Marcus Aurelius really takes on the responsibility, and the Senate is complicit in this. They want him to take on the government.
As the sole emperor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's the one who kind of forces the issue with Lucius Verus. Very different to what we've seen before when the succession's left a bit vague in the hands of two people.
Yeah.
And the cases we've seen before are notorious emperors with Caligula and Nero. So Caligula, this is a long time back,
was made
co-heir with Tiberius's son, Tiberius Gemellus. He disappears pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And Nero with Britannicus, who's poisoned shortly afterwards.
Claudius's son, yeah.
Exactly. At this point, Marcus Aurelius engages his own daughter to Lucius Verus. So he makes that connection even stronger.
That cements the family ties even further.
Absolutely.
Are they true emperors together? Are they both equal?
Technically, yes. Because they've both got that very important power, which has been constant throughout the imperial period. They've got tribunician power. And remember, that's the power of veto. So they can overturn any ruling. They have proconsular power over the provinces. That's an immense amount of power because, of course, that means you control the armies in the provinces. You control the resources of the provinces. The main difference is that Marcus Aurelius is Pontifex Maximus because there can only be one. One chief priest. All right, you can't have two popes. That gives you slightly more authority in religious matters. So, yeah, they have approximately the same amount of power. But I think that it's pretty clear even at this point that Marcus Aurelius has more respect.
Lucius Verus can't pull rank on Marcus Aurelius, can he?
No.
But Marcus Aurelius can pull rank on Lucius Verus.
It does seem to happen.
Yeah.
But technically they should be equal. It's like a lot of Roman power. It's about authority. It's not necessarily about what's written down in policy.
Yeah.
Marcus Aurelius, I would say, has more authority.
Yeah.
So if he wanted to use it, which he rarely seems to, then he could pull rank. But I think a lot of Marcus Aurelius's authority lies in the fact that he doesn't want to pull rank.
So I like what they do on the first day. The first thing they do, they bury their father in Hadrian's tomb in the mausoleum. Then they went straight to the camp of the guard and give them lots of money because these two are not military men at all and they will need the soldiers on side.
20,000 sesterces.
So how much? A lot of money.
Yeah, 3 years of pay. Can I have 3 years of pay now? No, it's a good incentive and it's a good diplomatic move.
Yeah, it shows how important it is to keep the military on side at the time.
It's always been important and the emperors who don't do it really suffer.
So Rome now has two emperors and two that are so different. You've got Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher, the stoic, the very cautious, very level-minded person. And you've got Lucius Verus, who, as you've got in the notes here, the playboy prince. So they couldn't be more different.
Yeah, and yet, strangely, it seems to work. One of the ways it seems to work is that almost immediately there is a need to be involved with the military. There's a need to go to war.
Yeah.
And Marcus Aurelius, who's had all that experience of domestic administration, sends Lucius Verus off. You can see how it could work if these people will get on and will cooperate because it means that you can have an emperor who will stay and hold the empire together while somebody else can go away and deal with an uprising or a war.
Mm.
So it's kind of the perfect scenario in some ways, although many would argue that Lucius Verus doesn't really take those responsibilities terribly seriously either. We have to speculate, I suppose, when it's all about character. But we can speculate that Marcus Aurelius isn't particularly, he doesn't need Lucius Verus to recognize him as the more powerful one. And Lucius Verus doesn't really mind because he's not terribly interested in being dominant either. He's not interested in having the responsibility. So it sort of works for that reason in that neither of them seems to want to pull rank on the other.
So if it was two people of different temperaments other than this... Well, we've seen how that works has worked in the past. It could have all fallen apart.
Well, it's the danger always with monarchies, isn't it? And it's even more of a danger when you've got two people, that if their personalities are wrong, then that's going to be bad for the entire empire.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes. Please leave a review or a rating. In fact, you should do that for all the podcasts that you love. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, MA and LV have a Parthian problem. The Parthians have had it coming for a while now. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.